humans as a species have used other animals for food, clothing, companionship, and more for a long, long time. And more recently, humans have caused more and more generalized harm to animals. Things like air pollution affecting birds, habitat destruction limiting the range of migratory animals, plastic in the ocean getting in the stomachs of whales. Our next guest says we have a large and in many ways growing debt to pay these animals. She says we can start by getting the law to work more in their favor to protect their ability to flourish. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about animal well-being? Is there a change you'd like to see made in our legal system, in our world, in our attitude toward animals? What is it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Martha Nussbaum is the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Law and Philosophy Department at the University of Chicago. She's the author of many books on philosophy, economic development, and more. Her newest book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. Martha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to this.
You've written so many books over the years about philosophy and ethics as it applies to humans. What led you into considering justice for animals?
Well, I've been thinking about that for quite a long time. But even more because my daughter became a lawyer for animal rights, and she was working for an NGO called Friends of Animals. And then in 2019, she died very tragically. So that made me think a lot more about writing a book on this topic. In fact, even when she was ill, I was already writing the book, and she knew about it, and we had co-authored some articles together. But it was really my daughter that opened my eyes to the huge problems of animals when they're outside our national control. Whales were her particular passion. And so I learned a lot from her, and then I took it from there and studied many other kinds of animals. And, you know, there's so much good science about animals, and we know so much about the wonderful things they are capable of if they can have a chance to flourish. So that is really what started me writing this book.
I want to talk about that idea of animal flourishing. A key concept to your book is something called the capability approach. Again, this is something that you've talked about when it comes to people. What do we mean about the capability approach when it comes to recognizing the well-being, the flourishing of non-human animals?
Okay, first of all, what it means is we don't think that an animal is worth protecting only because it's like us. It's each form of life has its own complexity and its own activities. And so the capabilities approach says, look at each form of life, and don't you think that each animal should have a chance to live a characteristic life of that species without human thwarting? But then it's also not focused narrowly on just one thing. I think utilitarians like Peter Singer have done a lot of good for animals by focusing on pain. But pain is not the only thing that's important in animal life. If we could just end all the pain that we cause to animals, that would be huge progress. But many zoos do not inflict pain on animals. And if the animal is born in a zoo, it really doesn't know what a real life for an elephant or for another large animal would actually be like. So animals need company, and company that's usually very complicated. Elephants need a large herd that couldn't possibly be in a zoo. Whales need pods, and dolphins too, of a large number of creatures. And so this leads me to a critique of zoos, among other things. But anyway, an animal needs lots of things. It needs room to move around in. It needs care and attention. And it depends on the kind of animal it is. What it needs varies with the kind. So that's what the capabilities approach says. Capabilities are not inside abilities. They are spaces for choice. They're opportunities to choose to live a life of the kind of creature you are. And so we should be creating those spaces in our world where a whale could live a whale life without getting choked by plastic and dinned in its ears by sonar, where elephants could wander and eat and wander across large tracts of land without dangers of poaching and without habitat destruction, and so on for every kind of animal.
You're calling for legal changes, and we can talk about that in a bit. You're also, I think, asking us to change as individuals how we think about animals. You give a series of emotions you're hoping we talk about, starting with a sense of wonder at our animal neighbors. How can we grasp that and kindle that?
Well, I've worked on emotions for a lot of my career as a philosopher, so it was natural for me to start there. And wonder, I think, is a good starting point, because when we look at animals, we don't just see something cheap and uninteresting. We're inclined to say, wow, isn't that amazing what whales can do, or what elephants can do, or what birds can do. We know so much now about birds. So wonder draws our attention to the creature and makes us see this creature as worthwhile, as an end, and not just a means of our own goals. And then when we have wonder, and then we also notice that the creature is suffering because of stuff that we've done, then I think we ought to feel great compassion. But then the compassion is not just, oh, poor elephant, but it's linked to a sense of, isn't it outrageous that this happens? We must change this. So it's kind of not a kind of anger that just beats people over the head with retribution, but a kind that faces forward. I call it transition anger. We turn forward to ask, what can we now do about this outrageous behavior?
We're talking to Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in with your reactions to what she's saying, your thoughts, changes you'd like to see in the way we humans interact with our animal neighbors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. I believe that veganism is the future of the planet. Conventional animal raising is not sustainable. We can get all the protein we need from vegetables, and industrial agriculture for supporting animals for food is killing us and the planet.
Kent, thanks for the call. Martha, not surprisingly, you talk about the way we raise animals and use them for food. What are your thoughts for Kent?
Well, I think the factory farming industry is a great moral horror. So I totally agree with Kent about that. And it's the first place I would want to start in making change, because it's got a stranglehold over American politics, so that it's very hard to make any other change until you first change that. But I also think that I don't totally agree with veganism in every respect. So let me have a kind of respectful disagreement with Kent. Veganism says, for example, we shouldn't wear things made of wool because that involves shearing sheep. Well, sheep have evolved in such a way that the coat burdens them. They will lead worse sheep lives if their coat is not shorn. So I see nothing wrong with wearing things made from wool. So there are many other places where we could have other examples like that. But I think the main thing should be to treat the animal as an end and to help it lead a flourishing life as the kind of animal it is. But I would certainly agree that stopping the factory farming industry, and how can we do that? Now, they have so much power that they've been able to pass in most states laws that are called ag-gag laws, meaning that they put a gag on people who want to be whistleblowers about the terrible conditions in the factory farming industry. And those laws have been repealed in 9 states, but they're still on the books in many other states. So if I wanted to take a video camera and go into the slaughterhouse and photograph what goes on there, I would be breaking the law. So these things first have to be stopped. Then when we can have true reporting about what's really going on, and of course we do have now books that describe the problem, but we need many more documentaries and videos, then the consciousness of everyone will be awakened, and then there will be a movement to end this terrible, terrible industry.
Kent, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Martha, we could take a couple of approaches to something like that. We could say all or nothing. We completely stop using animals for meat, or we live with what we've got. You see some room in some areas, I don't know about this one, in some areas for incremental improvements that we should be encouraged by. What would you see as some steps in that direction?
Well, I'm what is sometimes pejoratively called a liberal revisionist. That is to say, I do think it's right to make incremental progress. And when you think about the women's movement, something that I've written about a great deal, rather than saying all men are bad and let's separate from them and let's have a radical revolution, I was always in favor of trying to persuade, trying to bring people over and make legal progress gradually. So that's my approach here too, but I think it still is important to stop the worst horrors first. And the factory farming industry is certainly one of the worst horrors. However, it's so powerful in the US, unlike Europe, where actually a lot of reforms have already been introduced. In the US, people who are even candidates for high office have to meet with the American Farm Institute before they could be up for Senate confirmation. And so we have to break the stranglehold of that industry over our political life. And that's very, very difficult. But in the meantime, we can try to tell the truth about that industry, persuade people to change their own individual lives. And gradually, I think the law will catch up.
We're talking to Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Her new book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts, your reactions, your questions. Is there a particular animal that you are particularly concerned about that you'd like to see changes made to make their lives better? Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest on the philosophy, the ethics, the law surrounding the well-being of animals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Martha Nussbaum, law and ethics professor at the University of Chicago. We're talking about her new book. It's called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts or concerns about animal welfare, animal cruelty, how we treat them in agriculture, in the wild, join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions, your own experiences, decisions you've made in your personal life at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Martha, a big part of your argument in the book is that you hope that legal systems around the world can take these ideas of animal thriving, their well-being, and account for them and represent those interests somehow. What could that look like?
Well, it has to have many layers. Right now, animals that are companion animals, animals we live with, are fairly well protected by local and state laws and some national laws, but those laws are not always enforced. So the first thing we need is that animals have to have what's known in the law as standing, that is the right to go to court as the plaintiff of an action. And of course, like humans, they don't go to court themselves. There's a lawyer, and in the case of non-human animals, there would be a guardian who represents the animals and hires the lawyer. But right now, no one can go and challenge the non-enforcement of the laws, because to have standing, you have to have what's known as a particularized injury, and no human qualifies for that, even if you're totally morally outraged by what you see going on. And so there has to be a change in that. And there are four countries in the world, Colombia, Ecuador, and Argentina, and India, where animals, in fact, do have that kind of legal status. And therefore, you can bring a suit in the name of the animal. So that's one very obvious change that I would like to see. But another is just more and better laws. So when we get outside the boundaries of the local, animals are not very well protected. We have some very good national laws like the Migratory Birds Treaty Act, the Marine Mammals Protection Act, and the Animal Welfare Act. Those are all federal laws, but they leave out the animals we eat. They just didn't want to have that discussion. So the bird treaty says, oh, it's just migratory birds, not the birds we eat, and so forth. Now, those laws are pretty good, but again, they need better enforcement. Now, courts play an active role in this. So I give an example in my book of a very wonderful Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that interpreted the Marine Mammal Protection Act in a way that recognized the complex form of life that whales live. They saw that the Navy sonar program, while it didn't actually inflict pain on the whales, it did disrupt characteristic activities, migration, and it disrupted their mating activities. It made them migrate with reduced energy. It created heightened stress and so on. So they actually required the Navy to terminate its sonar program. That was a big win for animal protection. But of course, now that's in the coastal areas of the US, out in the high seas, so to speak, whales have almost no protection. They're suffering from plastic pollution. They eat plastic and it fills them up, and then they get so full that they die of starvation because they can't eat anything else. The plastic just stays there and it calcifies. They also suffer from noise. Oil drillers are drilling all over the ocean, and they're charting the ocean floor by sending sort of air bombs down to chart the contour of the ocean floor. And these air bombs make huge racket all the time. Whales navigate the world not so much by sight or by smell, but mostly by hearing. So it's created a great deal of stress for all whales. But what do we have? We have a thing called the International Whaling Commission. It was founded, however, to stop harpooning a little bit, to curtail it a little bit, in order to make sure that there are enough whales to be hunted in the future. So it was not a whale protective agency in the least. Over time, it's become somewhat more whale protective, and there's been a moratorium now on all harpooning, but it doesn't do anything about the other things that whales suffer from. And furthermore, nations have to join it voluntarily. Well, that's the problem with all international law, of course. If people don't want to do it, they just don't do it. So Japan, which didn't like the moratorium on whale harpooning, they just quit the International Whaling Commission. And so we really need a much better, more cooperative, and more enforceable international system. And I think the only way we're going to get that is raising public awareness around the world. And so that's one thing I want my book to do, because it's because people don't really know what's going on that they tolerate this. And I think if they really understood the sufferings of whales and dolphins and so on from the lack of law, then they would create a better system of law.
Talking to Martha Nussbaum about her new book. It's called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. She looks at philosophy and the law and animal well-being. Martha, the suffering you outline in the book, it would be easy to look at the enormity of it you point out and I guess be overwhelmed or discouraged. I think that's pretty clearly not what you're hoping people come out of your book taking. You point towards some signs of hope. Where do you point people toward?
Well, I think there is legal progress. Certainly there's progress in the protection of companion animals, but we also see inroads, as I mentioned before, some of the bad laws that the factory farming industry passed to prevent whistleblowing, those have now been repealed. And so we see progress in that way. As I said, the International Whaling Commission, bad though it is, has become better. It's declared a moratorium on harpooning. But I think the main thing that for people should think about is that every single person can do something. You can talk about animals and try to build a legal movement to protect one particular kind of animal you're interested in. You can, if you're a teacher or a parent, show videos. There's so much good information about animals that you can show in classrooms or to your children, just to show what their lives are like and get people interested in that. The Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, which I love, has countless bird calls that you can listen to, and you can learn about the life of each kind of bird and why it's precious. So whatever your position in the world is, there's something that you can do. You can join a local movement, you can join an international movement, and of course there's the movement to stop poaching, which has deprived many elephants of their lives. So they're just, everyone has something that they can contribute. I think what I can contribute is writing a book, but you know that I'm not an activist and I'm not doing a lot of the great work that activists are doing. So there are just many places that you can contribute, and I hope everyone here will realize that you can learn, and that already is progress, and there's something that you can be doing for animals in the world.
Martha, you pointed toward a couple of signs of legal changes. Do you feel, as you're talking to people about your book, that there is this kind of mindset change in the way we think of the well-being animals in the works?
I do think so. I think, of course, it happens first of all, in the case of animals that we live with. And I think that has really changed. People think of dogs and cats as beloved members of their family rather than as just tools. I don't like the word pet. I hope it will go out of existence because that word is kind of condescending. It treats the animal like a toy. But I think most people now do not treat their beloved dogs and cats like mere toys. I don't think they always treat them exactly well. I think dogs need a lot more exercise than they often get. They need a lot more close attention and interaction than they sometimes get. But, you know, people's intentions are good, and they really do love these creatures. So now the next question is how to educate people about other kinds of animals whose lives are just as rich, just as interesting and complex. And they may be lovable like elephants, or they may not be so very lovable, like coyotes are really interesting animals, and more they live in our cities. So just educating people and getting them not to be afraid of a coyote and not to say, oh, we should shoot it on sight, because coyotes are actually very passive. They don't attack other animals or children, but they can be kept under control in our cities without killing them. So people need to just educate themselves and learn where the risks are to animal life and what they want to do about it. And I do see many, many signs of that happening. My daughter worked for this NGO that worked on wild animals, not so much domestic animals. And the wild animals, you know, there are lots of wild animals in the United States. She was particularly interested in whales, but that was really not in her office work. Her office work was concerned with creatures like the American bison, the wild horses, who are increasingly, there's a war between the cattle ranchers in Wyoming and the wild horses.
So we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Martha Nussbaum. Her new book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility.